Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. So this is part three of our exploration of what ethics and morals might look like if considered from outside of, or maybe I would say more accurately, from beyond the bounds of religion. And I've said this several times, but I'm going to say it again, and I'll probably recap it. The core idea here is not that one can't be religious and have robust ethics and morals in their life. Of course we can. And of course many people do. I don't think we have to look very hard to find examples of deeply religious folks whose commitment to knowing and doing what is good and right runs deep. I think when we talk about somebody like Marie Sinclair, as we did this morning, we're talking about exactly that kind of a person. Somebody who has that practice embodied in their life. The reason that we're using the language of beyond is because for much of history of these sorts of matters in this part of the world, religious institutions have been the arbiters of ethics and morals. They have been, to be an arbiter means to be an institution that settles a dispute. They have been the institutions that settled the disputes or were the final authority on those sorts of matters. Now, this is interesting because at this moment in history, we might not feel like that's the case for lots of reasons. And one interesting reason is that in this part of the world, the values that underpin most systems of ethics and morals have their roots in Christianity. That might sound a little bit counterintuitive. I've just been talking about why we might not feel like that's the case. And here I could sound like I'm making the opposite case. So stay with me. If the roots of these systems are within the Christian belief system, why don't we feel like that system has the last word? And the reason might be, we'll unpack some other ones, but one reason might be, is because that way of looking at the world, that lens on the world, is so embedded that in many instances it's pretty nearly invisible until you look for it. It's not that it's not there, it's that it's assumed. It's that it's like social gravity, societal gravity. It just is. Our notions of law, for instance, as a system, are grounded in this worldview. But that system, the system of law, is not something that we would speak of as a religious system. It's a societal system, right? So we make this kind of interesting distinction. And when it comes to those kinds of systems, like law, for example, to the degree that they stand in the worldview of Christianity, they also stand in something older, because Christianity, of course, stands on Judaism. Historically. And in the Judaist tradition, philosophical tradition, there's a lively engagement with the thinking of the Greeks in the Western philosophical tradition of ethics, even though Judaism doesn't take on that system. It interacts with it. Anyway. Trust me, that's a rabbit hole you can fall into and make a career out of and never surface again. But in the interest of our particular exploration, I'm going to really shortcut some big complexities. This is not my way of saying that those complexities aren't worth exploring if they're of interest to you, but I want to try to make a case for why it might be time to look beyond them. So I want to stay with that beyond language. Behind the curtain of all the systems of belief I've just referenced, and many others, is some sort of concept of personified authoritative deity. And that the character of the deity in the religious narratives isn't just important. That character represents, in those systems of belief, in those mythologies, they represent the last word or the final authority. The buck stops there. So God says is the ethical and moral bottom line from that vantage point. Now, as anybody who grew up around religion probably knows, what God says is subject to considerable interpretation and debate, and inevitably involves working with some sources that we can get our hands on. Generally speaking, those are texts, as a shared reference point, and of course the debate also extends to the nature and authority of those texts, right? So if you really want a current glimpse of what this debate sometimes looks and sounds like in the popular media, as distinct from the academic discourse, all you have to do is consider the ways in which the Bible was referenced in the recent American election runoff. Pretty stark. In the final event, within religious structures, what those thinking about and teaching about these matters are trying to resolve is, what is the moral and ethical problem we're trying to solve? So what's our dilemma? And how do we understand that problem relative to our understanding of what God says? Right? So they're sort of sketched very simply and starkly and leaving many things out. There's the problem. In the context of what we're exploring in this series, this is important because exploring ethics beyond religion, this intersection that I've just been trying to describe here, that's where the paths diverge. As essential as that what does God say or what would Jesus do question is within its religious bounds, so in its context, it's largely irrelevant as a benchmark for anyone that doesn't hold those beliefs. Like, who cares? If you don't believe in God, then who cares what God says? If you don't believe that Jesus is a deity, then that authority is detached. So who cares what Jesus says, right? If you believe that Jesus is a Jewish rabbi and not a deity, then that adjusts his place in this whole conversation as authority, right? So all to say, if somebody doesn't hold the beliefs that have that as the bottom line, then those beliefs are irrelevant to them. Or they're in declining relevance for those that are in the process of reconsidering holding the religious beliefs that underpin those ideas. Right? So if you're in the process of what is often sort of popularly called deconstruction, you know, that might put you at this kind of an intersection or along this kind of a path, right? Where you're like, how relevant is that to me? So that's kind of how that functions. Also, this is an important intersection because in our shrinking world, millions of people follow no particular religion. Lots and lots of people. Millions more are in the process of leaving the religion their parents followed or whatever was the dominant one in their surrounding culture. And also, most of us no longer inhabit a world in which cultures are isolated from one another. We live in a multicultural reality, and we don't have to make an effort to be proximate to people and beliefs that are different from whatever we grew up with. In fact, we have to work rather hard, perhaps even take aggressive or sometimes violent measures to try to keep ourselves clear of people that are different from us, if that's what we want to do, and the way we want to live. Because that's not the world we're living in. This might have actually been pretty easy to do when simply living in literal Valley A instead of Valley B was enough to be part of an isolated culture with its own language, customs, and beliefs. And it's really not that hard to find relatively contemporary studies where people are like, what in the world? You mean you spoke this language and you spoke that language and you're like, you know, 100 miles apart? Yeah, but there's a mountain range in the middle. And that did the job, right? Kept the culture separate. But I'm ready to go on record, happy to go on record as saying that ship has sailed and we're not going back. No matter what kind of attempts might be made in that direction, and there are attempts being made in various places in that direction. One of the implications of this is that ethics based exclusively on any one religion would only appeal to some of us, right? To the rest of us, that system would not be meaningful. And if our ethics aren't meaningful to us, we're not going to practice them. And if we don't personally practice them, then we certainly won't collectively practice them. And if there's no shared ethical and moral commitments in a culture, then problems like injustice, corruption, inequity, intolerance, greed, those are going to persist. Because those problems are not actually the problem. They're the symptoms. And what they're the symptoms of is of the neglect of inner values, of alive in me ethics and morals. And beyond that, the dilemmas represented by words like injustice, corruption, inequity, intolerance, greed, those are big, sturdy problems. They require us pulling together as a species to address them. Isolated and competing systems of belief are not going to cut it when it comes to taking on the biggies. So what we're looking for is a way to think about ethics and to practice ethics that is equally acceptable to those with a religious framework to their beliefs, what we often call faith. I'll take up some of my objections with that language in a moment. I think there's a conflation here that's not helpful, but I'm going to say to those who have a religious framework to their beliefs and to those who don't have that kind of framework. That's what we're probing with this exploration. Now, I'm going to contend for an idea here that might not just sit all comfy and cozy with sort of where the dominant culture is around language and this issue. I think we could reasonably call an idea like what I've been trying to describe, that kind of an ethic, I think we could call that secular ethics. Now, I don't personally find that language especially satisfying, which might mostly be a me problem, because I grew up being taught that secular was the enemy, that if something was secular, it was lesser. We've used that language here this morning. You described faith as measured over against secular in the same sentence, right? So it's a really common system for anybody who grew up around Christianity in this age, in this part of the world. The focus on justice presented in People Get Ready, it's very ancient. It's very eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, God judges, no escaping that judgment, right? So again, that's sort of how that ideology is framed. I don't think it's that surprising that I was taught this, given that the wider framework in which much of my religious education happened regarded the holders and purveyors of the beliefs I was being taught as the embattled defenders of big T truth. The word itself is interesting. The official definition of the word secular reflects that powerful, deeply embedded influence of Christian religion on the shaping of dominant culture. So I didn't look this up in a religious dictionary. I looked up secular in the Oxford Languages Dictionary, right? Common source. If you look it up in that source, this is the first definition of the word secular. Denoting attitudes, activities, and other things that have no religious or spiritual basis. Right. So, again, Oxford Languages Dictionary. The example, the sentence that was used in a sentence, you know, that helpful little, if you want to use it in a sentence, the example was secular buildings. Interesting. I watched the new Springsteen doc last week, getting ready for the show. Man, if I can be in my 70s and still rocking, I'm just like, I found the fountain, right? I'm drinking from the fountain of youth, apparently. I did get sick and had to rearrange some dates. I found that vaguely reassuring in terms of age and stage. Anyway, I watched the Springsteen doc last week, and more than one member of the band in that doc, when they're trying to describe what this current tour's concerts feel like, used the word spiritual. The percussionist, interesting guy, not part of the E Street Band over all the years, for those of you that follow, new member for the tour, said, quote, "This is church." And the way the people who shot that thing cut it, it looked like church, depending on the church you grew up in. But despite Springsteen's occasional tapping into religious imagery, which he does, there's nothing overtly identified as religious going on in those shows. We are surrounded by, we may ourselves identify as, people who are spiritual but not religious. The language is shifting, following the ways, in this case, that it's being used. Language is like that. It can both lead and follow in the ebb and flow of cultural formation. So I would say that that definition that I shared with you from the Oxford Languages is not especially current. We need to separate religious and spiritual in terms of what the language is doing in the culture. All to say this, when we talk about a secular ethic or secular morals, we don't need to understand that to be anti-religious. That's not a given. We might be used to that being taken as a given, but it's not. It's very contextual. If the religion we're measuring secular next to is anti-everything that isn't us, then the notion that secular is the antithesis of religion might hold together just fine in that context. But if the religion in question encourages us to work for the welfare and benefit of all within or beyond the bounds of a particular religious group, then secular works just fine. Not going to spend any more time on that. When I was working on this talking bit, one of the things I did was look outside of my own religious tradition of origin to see how this whole religious secular conversation might be different in another context. And what I discovered was fascinating. Turns out, for instance, that an ancient Indian, not Turtle Island indigenous, but from the continent, It turns out that in ancient Indian thought, the principles of nonviolence and interreligious harmony are both deeply ingrained. And the language that the scholars use for that in that context is secularism. That was the term. So as we can easily see, there's plenty of room for that concept, in that concept, for religions, plural. Right? In a world like we share, it's very likely that our neighbor, our colleague, our employer is going to have a different original language. They're going to eat different food. They're going to follow a different religion. It's not especially hard to see that in that kind of world, we need to find ways to cooperate with one another in a spirit of mutual acceptance and respect. And there are, of course, lots of people for whom that diversity is fascinating and enriching, and there are many others for whom that is not the case. And it's pretty easy these days to see the outcome of that. It creates confusion and fear and resentment and all too often open hostility. And that climate is one that nurtures ideologies of exclusion based on parameters like race, nationality, or religion. The temperature in the conflict goes up. I would say, and only history will tell, this, I'm not making any claim to being able to see the future here, but I think that given the likelihood of migration continuing to be propelled by things like war and climate change, economic hardship, scarcity of fundamentals, things like water, I don't think that's likely to dial down anytime soon. So the need for a sustainable, and I would say, I want to be careful with my language here, so I've added more to this idea because the idea of something being universal is extremely challenging, but I think the need for a sustainable and more universal approach to ethics, inner values, and personal integrity is urgent. This is not a luxury conversation, I don't think, from where I sit. So for the purposes of this exploration, that's how I'm going to use the notion of secular as language to represent that kind of an approach. As always at the table, my hope for these talky bits is that they get us thinking for ourselves and conversing with one another. So feel free to disagree. That's built in, of course. My hope is that I've explained my reasoning well enough that we can helpfully use this as shared language in this context. All right? So there's some limitations to that. By way of a closer-to-home illustration, as with personal pronouns, for example, we might be at or even well beyond the point where we need some new words for this. But this is what we've got for now. So they, them, it is. Secular, redefined, you know, and all of that. Language in the process of actively evolving. So what we're looking for is, in the sense that I'm using the words, a secular, able to be used by everyone, approach to ethics. And in an exploration like this, we could think of that metaphorically as being like the North Star. As with the literal star, it's something to help us orient ourselves by, something to reference as we navigate, rather than a destination that we'll literally arrive at. To put it another way, what we're looking for is a way to ground inner values without contradicting. And if you listen to this sentence and feel like, Tim, you're describing something impossible, check your idea history. Just listen to the whole sentence and you'll see what I mean, I think. We're looking for a way to ground inner values without contradicting any religion and also without depending on any religion. We're looking for a way to promote a greater understanding of the need for ethical awareness and inner values at a point in history where the narratives of me, mine, and materialism seem to have become dominant and destructive. This is not a little maneuver. And just because, in my experience at least, it seems like I can say some things over and over and still have them be misunderstood, let me recap an important distinction. The world's major religions all emphasize love, compassion, patience, tolerance, forgiveness in various ways and to varying degrees. And they can and do promote inner values. But the reality of the world we're living in is that grounding ethics in religion alone is no longer adequate. We need to find a way of thinking about ethics, and I'm going to also say spirituality, that is beyond, not exclusive of, but beyond the bounds of religion. So where do we go from there? In my, you know, put the cart before the horse talkie bit a couple of weeks ago, I suggested that in the end we'll be considering something we might represent with a word like compassion. So in many ways, that's where we're headed. But along the way, there are some other possibilities that loom large that need to be considered as contenders as the basis of ethics beyond religion. There are other systems that we're surrounded by, and many of them we take for granted. including religion, that really have some skin in the game on this. And so we're going to explore some of those when we get back to this next. But along the way, we're gonna take the time to dig deeper into this part of the exploration. What would it look like to consider some of those other contenders from the vantage point of how might this work? If we stand on this basis or that basis, whatever one we're exploring, how might this work as being something that more of us as humans could work with together to resolve some of these big problems? So we're going to dig deeper into that next time we pick up this topic, but I'm going to leave it right there for today. Peace.